Oh, they're still talking about steak. It's been like 40 minutes. But, it is. That's what we're trying to do is not be a magic podcast. So.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, steak is something that affects a lot of people. We're all mostly our listener base is mostly male anyway, and mostly we like a good steak. So, if they don't like it, maybe they'll like the next one. Who knows?
In Magic the Gathering, offenses against the community are considered especially heinous. The dedicated podcast fans who investigate these crimes are members of an elite squad known as the Special Victims Unit. These are their stories.
All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of the SBU Cast. As usual, I'm here, Mike, also known as Robot Large on Twitter, and I've got my co-host here, Josh. Josh, how's it going?
Very good. Nice to hear your voice again.
Yeah, it's been a little while since we cast, just due to scheduling conflicts and some issues with my old man being sick, so it was good to get back in the saddle again.
Excellent, excellent.
Yeah, so tonight I just want to let everyone know that we got a special guest here. We've got Marcel, also known as on Twitter as Marcel MTG. Marcel,
hello.
How's it going?
It's doing fine. Thank you for having me on, guys.
Good, good. What we're going to cover tonight is we're going to talk a little bit about Marcel. We're going to get to know him and find out what the man behind the Twitter avatar is all about. We're going to talk a little bit about Marcel's meat, as I like to call it, and we'll leave it at that. You guys will have to listen as we move along, and we're just going to see where this takes us. So, let's go from there. Unless Josh, you got anything you want to cover before we start talking to Marcel?
No, let's get the train on the tracks.
All right, we'll just start with Marcel, and you can tell us about who this Marcel guy is.
Well, I currently live in San Francisco, California, but born and raised in Oakland, California, which
okay.
is across the bridge. It's like about 4 or 5 miles away. It's a vast difference, though. Every time I grew up as a child, San Francisco is a different place, and we kind of made fun of San Francisco, not because of the gay stuff, but just like San Francisco is very foofy, and
right.
There's a lot of yuppies in San Francisco, and everyone thought too full of themselves. San Francisco just seemed like they thought above and beyond. So, Oakland's a blue collar city. And so kind of just like there's a rivalry between San Francisco and Oakland. And so the fact that I'm living in San Francisco is very weird for me.
It's such a foreign concept to me as a small town Canadian guy that, 4 miles away can be a whole separate culture. When, where I live, 4 miles away is forest.
It's
like
wilderness, right?
There's no community, right? Like the next community next to me is 150 miles away.
Holy.
And so it takes an hour and a half of highway driving just to get there. So, for you to say, oh, well, it's across the bridge and it was such a different thing. I mean, it's so foreign to me.
Well, we have that in Chicago, and it's the north side and the south side is almost exactly the same dynamic that Marcel's talking about. The south side is extremely blue collar, shoulder to shoulder, you're super fans, right? Everyone's familiar with the Bears super fans. That's a south side guy. The north side has the Cubs and Wrigleyville, and Goose Island was there, and it's very, I don't want to say yuppie-ish because we're kind of past that, but it's the more the young professional who wants the prestige of living in Wicker Park or all of these places. So yeah, that dynamic, it may be foreign to you, Mike, but for here, it's absolutely prevalent. There are people on the south side of Chicago that have never been to the north side of Chicago.
And that's crazy to me. Like it just like, that's so foreign to me. And I know it's happens in places here in Canada too. I'm sure around Toronto and Vancouver, the big urban centers, and even in Montreal to some degree, I'm sure too. But for me, that just seems so foreign that, you could be that close and not experience it.
Yeah, the fact that you're not experiencing it is foreign to me, and people live like, in these desolate areas. Not to say it like that, but, it's kind of as far off, and how it's so far off is foreign to me. But it's, that's how people live. Everything's a different cup of tea. And it's just interesting. Like my friend, he has like this property that it's like we go to that we go camping at, but there's no running water. We everything we got to bring, we come in. It's like no man's land. We get to shoot guns off, which we really can't do in the city where we live, you know, like because in a populated area, you got to go to a gun range to shoot.
Right.
So the fact you can shoot guns off at, you know, whatever you want to do whenever at random is like no man's land. But it's densely populated. Throughout the entire area, when we get to this property, there's people living here. There's people living there. It's, you know, even in a place that people consider, you know, how could someone live there? Someone likes to live there. That's their cup of tea. You know, there's something for everyone. So it's an interesting dynamic of how people are, I think.
I don't even know what's 150 miles from here that I could say that would be the next, you know, major, maybe the Springfield, perhaps the capital of my state, is 2.5 hours south of here. But I mean, 150 miles would just feel like there's no other people on the planet.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Especially, I mean, you say, what is it, 20,000 people in Prince Rupert?
Oh, Christ, no, it's more like 10.
Okay, so yeah, that's like the next town over from where the town my father lives in is about that size. So I couldn't imagine that. And then the next one is an hour and a half away. It would just be, that boggles my mind. And I've been to that part of the world. So, but you know, when you're on a cruise ship, it's, you're only seeing the centers of where people are.
Right, right.
You know, yes, they're a distance apart, but you don't realize that you're seeing the very next one.
Well, right? It's the population.
There was a whole bunch you missed, yeah.
It's the population differences too, right? Like if I add up the population of every community between here and the next largest, really the largest community in the north where I'm at, which is 9 hours away, if I added up every community's population in between, it's a fraction of what you guys have where you are. Like it's just, you know, it's all open space. Like it's an hour and a half to the next community. The community after that is 2.5 hours away. You know, it's like just empty forest up here, whereas, you know, obviously for you guys, you have to go out of your way to find that kind of
way
like way out of your way.
The greater Chicago area, I think, is like 11 or 15 million people.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, see, like Oakland, we got backyards in Oakland. We got front yards in Oakland and San Francisco. They don't, you know, they're like literally a lot of the houses are right butt up on the street. There's barely a backyard or something. So,
yeah,
you know, I feel that's like a concentration. But then I hear like New York is way beyond whatever San Francisco is. I haven't been to New York. I'm Chicago. I'm pretty sure is very similar because Chicago is an old city, very tall city. So like it's that's very, something
I have. It's a very classic looking city. Yeah, so, I can imagine that New York's very similar to Chicago. A lot of people, Chicago was called the second city, and it gets this reputation as being New York done right. In that it's easier to drive through, at least downtown. Once you get to the north side, everything goes off on angles and it doesn't make sense. There's this, you know, this mental image that we have of what a city looks like. And the only two cities I've seen in my entire life that look like cities to me are New York and Chicago. Everything else, you know, has like 10 skyscrapers. It's 10 is this extremely small number. There's, I mean, Chicago has, I don't know, 80. It's just, it looks like a city. So when people come to Chicago for the first time, generally they're awed by just the enormity of what the city looks like. And I've been here my whole life, so it's not like it's not spectacular to me when I think about it. But then when I see like St. Louis or Dallas or any of these other places, and they're like, this is the city. And it's like, it's not even a city. You know, there's space in between your buildings. How can this be a city?
Yeah, it really puts it in perspective for me because we do get a fair amount of – being on the coast, we get a fair amount of tourist traffic, and a lot of them are Americans. So it kind of, you know, helps me appreciate why they are taking pictures of just like, you know, trees
or, it's,
you know, yeah, mountains or whatever, right?
Vancouver looked like a city when I was there. But yeah, it wasn't – you know, we get to Vancouver and it's like – the only fact about the entire city my father told me was that's the tallest air traffic control tower in the world because it's on top of a skyscraper, and that looked pretty cool. And other than that, my jaw was on the floor because in every direction I looked, there was a mountain.
Yeah.
And it was just gorgeous and fantastic, and you'd probably be like, those are buildings. They're awesome. It's just a complete reversal, right?
So, well, it's like, I'm sure being in the wide open space is really, scary to people that are not used to it. Whereas for me, big cities, even Vancouver, and I haven't traveled much in the States, but places where you live are extremely intimidating to me. Mm-hmm.
See, and that's one of the benefits of California, the fact that I can probably get to all these different scenes that you're talking about within about a 6-mile drive one direction or another. I could go to the snow in Tahoe. I could go up to the redwoods up in Northern California. I could go to the beach. That's not necessarily a very sunny beach, but,
San Francisco. Great seafood, though.
Yeah, good seafood beach, get good oysters. Yeah. Or I could drive down, to LA and get a nice, sunny beach, you could go to the Napa Valley. So there's benefits to that. So I could get to experience those all in one. And so I guess, that's part of the benefit of living in California.
That would be a great place to, live, where you can at least in short spurts, you can get to whatever kind of, a climate or area that you're looking for. So that's pretty cool.
It takes me days of travel to get to a mountain. Days and days of travel.
To get to a
real actual mountain. I mean, I can get to like the Smoky Mountains, which are more like really big hills, but to see a mountain like Vancouver or Yosemite, places that are, those are mountains. Idaho. So
I've grown up with the mountains. So for me, if I'm not around mountains, I'm like feeling exposed and naked. I'm just like, fuck, like what's this open space bullshit?
If anyone gives you a free trip to Indiana, don't go, because it's the flattest. I'm fairly certain at no point in the entire state could you put a marble on the ground and it would roll in any other direction.
That's how I felt about it when I went to Texas. When I went to Texas, it was like that. I was like, wow, it's like pure flatlands. Like it was unreal. Yeah. If you're from out where you live and you see mountains, that just see them flatlands and nothing but flatlands across the entire horizon will just freak you out.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So, what was it like growing up in Oakland?
It was definitely interesting. I'm a white guy, and Oakland's a chocolate city, so you could say I'm the racial minority in Oakland,
right?
And so it was a little tough on that end, but. It was great. As far as Oakland's a very cultural city, a proud city. And growing up, my experiences that I could take on into adulthood is going to carry on for life. And like, I love every bit of life that I grew up with, the hard times and the good times and the bad times. And, I'm just, I love Oakland. Oakland is a sign of pride. I'm glad that I grew up there. And
cool. Well, hopefully we didn't just blow everyone's mind, because, you're a white guy, but you got a voice that probably leads people to believe that you're not.
And anyone who hasn't seen your picture believes that you're lying.
Yeah, so I know.
I hope
every
that
single one of them goes,
yeah,
no white guy I've ever heard in my entire life sounds like that.
Well, hopefully there aren't listeners that are just like, oh my God, what do you mean he's white?
He's white? No way. Yeah, but.
Yeah, I got to deal with that all the time. I mean, even at work, like my coworkers, they're like, you're not mixed? Like, huh? Like, I could have sworn. You met my dad, you met my mom. No, I'm not mixed. No. But that's Oakland, it's just like, that's how people talk. Like, it's, people talk like this. There's a certain swag you get just living out here. Like, you should see. Like, we got a lot of Asians out here, and they'll cuss and say the N-word like no tomorrow, and you'd be like, wow, this is surreal. People come from out of state and they look at it, it's like, this is surreal, but this is how it gets down. People get down like that out here,
right?
And it's it's just part of the culture. So I mean, it's my voice. I'm not trying to be something that I'm not, but
if I could sound like that, I'd fake it.
So are your parents still in Oakland or?
In Oakland, they grew up in a suburb not too far away, called Fremont. And my dad made it purpose. He was like, "Yeah, my kids are gonna grow up in Oakland," and they came out here, and I lived out here basically for about 30 years, and then I moved over to San Francisco for work reasons. It's better for commute, but. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cool. Now, so you have brothers and sisters, or at least one brother that I remember you talking about.
Yeah, I got a brother and a sister, but I'm the oldest. So I got all the bullshit and that I had the worst ever, you know. Oh, man, why do they get it so easy and I got to deal with all this?
It's every time. Yes.
I am also the oldest of two, so I get that.
I'm the oldest of four.
Oh, man.
Yeah. The responsibility of being the oldest child is something that people who aren't the oldest child don't understand.
So by the time the parents get down to number four, I mean, they just are, you know, that kid's living the high life.
Yeah.
Because
they got the shortcuts.
Yeah, the parents are so battle-tested, they just don't give a shit about stuff anymore.
Exactly. They micromanage you because, you know, they're your first child.
Yeah.
And you're just step into the world and they're going to be judged based upon, you know, how they take care of the kid. But by kid number five, they're like, well, whatever, you know, he's going to be what it is. And, you know, more power to him. You know?
Yeah. But then as the oldest kid, you're like, hey, that's bullshit.
Every single time. Like, how in the hell are they getting a CD player when they're nine? I got one at 17.
Exactly. I had to make do listening to the radio the entire time with my ear there. I couldn't even have a Walkman. Ooh.
Yeah.
Yep. Holding the pause button on your cassette player so you could unpause it when your song came on and finally get a recording of it.
Oh, man. Now you're in my bailiwick, man.
Yeah. It's just it's hard for people who aren't oldest children to understand what being the oldest really is like. And I think all of the younger kids want to be the older one, and they don't. They just don't know that.
Yeah. So what kind of work do you do, Marcel? You were talking with us earlier about, you know, getting into the union and stuff. What kind of work do you do?
I work as a stagehand, but I've kind of branched off. So my union, we do a lot, basically theaters, concerts, conventions come in, movies also. So we basically take care of that. I've been more branching off into doing video and like audio visual. So like if a convention comes in, I'll be the guy that's the technician in the room that'll interact with the doctors, loading presentations, making everything on the screen, checking the sound, making sure projectors work, moving more into doing like graphics and like, you know, say there's a general session, you know, the videos that are playing and all that. So I'm moving more into doing more shows in that aspect. So it's a little stepping up the tier, you could say.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Yeah. So that totally that it totally explains why we've been seeing some video content from you in the Magic community.
Yeah, not as much as I would like, because it just takes so much effort. And
right.
I mean, it really does. You got to, I want to do more. Like, I wish I could do more.
Well, I think there's a hole that needs to be filled there. I mean, we look at all the different podcasts and different content and stuff, but when you look around, the only real video content we're getting is streaming, you know, people playing cards, which is great, don't get me wrong. But there's still, you know, there's still room in that whole genre of the video content for people to play around in there. And I think, you know, we could see some really great stuff.
Yeah, I completely agree. Did you see that the only, I mean, yeah, you get your streamers and whatnot, but the only, you know, game-centric video coverage that there really is, it's a Wizards property now, right? It's Walk the Plains. So
they're the Magic Show.
Well,
yeah, but it's not necessarily the same thing. The Magic Show is, it's about the game, right? But he doesn't really go to the conventions anymore like he used to. You know, he's not talking to the pros. He's not talking to the players, you know, doing the little skits that Nathan does before, that kind of thing.
So you want to see more Walk in the Plains type style videos, you're saying?
Well, seeing more, I think Walk in the Plains gets a lot of good publicity because if you can't go to a GP, what's a GP like? And it's one thing to watch the coverage, and sometimes they show the wide angle shot of look how many people are here, but when you actually get down to the he's walking between the tables and you actually get to see that, a lot of people just have to live vicariously through that, and he's like the only one it seems that's doing that. So I think there's room for maybe a more I don't want to say professional, but less humor based maybe.
Yeah,
you know, to see
I think
more
it's
of
wide open. I think there's more, you know, obviously the the magic show is different than what Walking the Plains is doing. I think there's a lot of room in between for playing. I think there's room for more of what we already have. I just think when I look around at the various sites, one of the things that catches my eye is that other than streaming video content,
there's a
serious hole there in the community. And I think, you know what, as Marcel said, it's a lot of work, which probably explains why there's so few products to consume.
Also, I think, you have the people who maybe not be comfortable in front of a camera. They might say, okay, I'm comfortable enough with my voice on a podcast, but I don't want to sit in front of a camera and I don't know how to make myself look good, and I don't know how to present myself to the camera like I'm talking to the person on the other side of the screen. So there's this it's just harder for them to do. Plus, you have to have the technical knowledge of, you know, instead of just plugging a headset into the computer and talking into it for a couple of hours of now you have to worry about light and the sound for that. And it's just a completely larger production that
For sure.
People might try and then just go, you know what, that was way too hard. Forget it.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of that. It's like, you know, once you start doing videos, you start pulling the string, and then you keep pulling the string. You're like, oh, my God, what did I start? You know?
Yeah.
Because you know, like anyone, you're gonna strive for perfection and quality if you're a master of your art or you care about what you do. Mm-hmm. And when you really start factoring in what it takes to make your production of a video better, it's like, oh, that's more time. Oh, I got to learn this process. Oh, I got to do this. And then you end up spending 100 hours on a 30-minute video, or you spend 80 hours just because you're tweaking these little things just to make it really work perfect. And that's where, I mean, I did a video for Worlds, Monday Night Magic, when I was on Monday Night Magic in 2010, and it was a fun video. There's things that I wish I would have done differently, but you know, it took a lot of effort to get all the stuff there, and then it took a lot, like almost 2-3 weeks just to go through all the videos and find what I liked, and then piecing it together and then making sure the timing's right. And even after I did it, I'm still finding imperfections and things I would have liked, and little, you know, maybe this visual effect here or this music could have been better here. And it's just, you know, like with podcasts, it's the same thing. It's like the process of getting through and, you know, getting your content out and then putting it out there is like it takes constantly having to make a consistent product and then doing it in a time frame that it doesn't suck up your free time is hard to do, you know, and that's the appeal of streaming, I think, is that people are able to do it without having to do more than just put their video up. They spend 3 hours, they do a video, and they got a video content out there that people consume, but they don't have to spend any time editing, which would just take, you know, that three, you know, cutting that down would be probably more than that 3 hours that they spent recording that to find the choice parts and putting it together.
And for the most part, they were going to do it anyway, right? They were probably going to sit there on Modo and play regardless if they were streaming. So there's no added, no, great, now I got to go play and stream, you know?
Yeah, well, and I think like anything, if you look at the existing streaming content, you know, there's varying qualities. It's slowly getting more and more professional, right? I mean, the days of just turning on your recorder and recording Modo are starting to fade away. I mean, people are they're introducing graphical templates, they're having guests, they're focusing on, you know, their backgrounds and, you know, all those things. Like Marcel said, I mean, you want to put out a professional product so you can up your game, you know, to get noticed a little better. You know, you look at a guy like Scotty Mac who does his stream, you know, he's put a lot of effort into the other parts of it other than just his, presentation and the recording part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it comes down to cost. Like, you know, like everything that it takes to get better, like trying to do it as a one-man team is impossible.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There's so many things. So when you do, like, the shows that I do, when the shows get more complex, you start adding in more labor, you know, shows get more expensive. But it just becomes a better quality product. So what it boils down to get the better quality, it costs money. And the problem is that a lot of this video content is provided free. So the time value that people are giving for what they get out of it is just not there. And it's like it really takes a dedication or, you know, something for someone to really put that much time and consistently do it for more than like a year or two. Like, I'm sure that the burnout factor is just insane for anyone doing videos. So,
yeah, well, if you look at all that effort that, you know, Evan Irwin put in in those early days before he got noticed by anyone, before he got hired. I mean, that was all for the love of doing it, right? Nobody's paying that dude to do any of it. And right. So it's going to take a pretty special guy. And I was also going to say, you know, as far as, you know, the labor and having a good team, I mean, that even goes for these podcasts that are put out, right? Like, I mean, Josh and I have Jason Mong, who does our audio editing. He saved my ass, right? I mean, I don't know how to audit audio. I would have had to learn a whole new skill set. So it's so nice for us just to be able to drop our file into a Dropbox and say, okay, Jason, there you go, work your magic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, and that's with the podcast. But then when you get into video, you're going to have someone doing lighting. You want to have a sound guy there, someone behind the camera. And then if you got an editing crew, you're going to probably have 2-3 people. And then maybe graphic. Then all of a sudden you're like, holy shit, I need a whole team just to make this one video right.
And
it's like,
yeah. And it, you know, at least with the audio podcasting, that team can be remote, right? I mean,
exactly.
They don't all have to be in one place. Good luck trying to find a team of dedicated people who want to do this all for free in right. one location.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why when we go to GP Portland and GP Montreal and I got my camera, I'm going to put some stuff together, but on. It's not going to be the best, like, it's not going to be the grand vision that I wanted. Every time I try to do a video, I'm like, oh, I'm going to do this and make this cool thing and make that. And then you end up like, no, that's not happening.
Yeah. Otherwise, it'll be 2016 by the time it comes out.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. So I had no idea that you actually worked in the field. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it makes it a little bit easier, you know, and it gives me an advantage to see, you know, top tier quality stuff so that I can try to emulate what they do right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Awesome. So, I just lost my train of thought.
Speaking of train of thought, what about this GP drunk train?
Yeah, that's the segue. Yeah. The GP drunk train. So that's about 3 weeks away. I'm really regretting that I can't make it for that.
Yeah.
I'm sure my liver isn't, because that sounds like it's going to be one big party.
Yeah, it's going to be a big party. It's going to be a lot of good food. I can't wait to see how you Canadians do it. I hear that it's going to be just delicious smoked meats everywhere.
Well, so. Montreal is renowned for its food and culture. So, that's going to be awesome.
What do you recommend? What should I look forward to? Or?
Oh, geez. Well, I've never actually been to Montreal, and that's quite a different scene from over on this side of the world. But, I wouldn't even know what to recommend, to be honest.
Well, it's French, right? So pick what you like French-wise and see what the Canadians do slightly different. Though you will be in Quebec, so a lot of them probably don't like to be called Canadians.
Yeah. We don't like to call them Canadians either.
Are you serious?
Quebec wants to be its own country. They don't want to be part of Canada.
Quebec is one of the provinces, right? You know, our equivalent of a state. And they have, on multiple occasions, threatened to just leave Canada.
Mm-hmm. How close have they came to actually doing it?
There was a vote once where they wanted, like, basically 50% plus one to pull it off. And they came close. I think it was, like, within 10%.
Wow. Yeah, it's
still far.
I don't know what the fuck would happen if that. I mean, it would just be a debacle if it happened. I mean, how when you consider that, you know, the country owns so many assets in a province, how do you just leave?
Right.
They're talking about splitting up California, actually.
Are they?
There's a motion to make it into 6 different states, which is absolutely not going to happen. Because that's
what they call them, California 1 through 6?
They were saying Silicon Valley. Yeah, South California, some other central.
Oh my God.
But I think there's probably a strong possibility that it could be split into two, though. And that we're going to deal with the same problem, you know, issues as far as like resources and the dividing of it. And, you know, because there's a lot of water up north and there's less water down south. And all of a sudden, you know.
Yeah, just all that infrastructure, right? I mean, Jesus, how do you split that up?
Yeah, I couldn't imagine. I feel. How would you feel by them? Do you feel that's betrayal by the Quebecans, or do you think they're just being, prideful of themselves?
There's a long history of sort of Quebec versus Western Canada. You know, like, we find it very hard to, relate to their specific needs. Like, they're just this, we want to be different. We have to be different. So treat us different. And there's not a lot of love for that out here in BC. I guess it gets a little bit more understanding as you get closer to their province. But from our point of view, yeah, I can't speak for the whole province of British Columbia, but there's certainly a sentiment of betrayal for sure. And what we run into, I mean, can you imagine in the United States if one of the states just said, you know what, we're going to become our own country?
Texas?
One of our states can become its own country. You have to remember that. Texas, by law, can secede.
At any point, it's written into their...
Yeah. For sure. But can you imagine what would happen if they actually did it? I mean, as sort of aggressive as the Americans are, I can't imagine the federal government ever letting a state just sort of walk out.
Well, they don't really have the capability of stopping Texas from doing it. It's actually, Texas has the right as a state to be its own country.
Yeah, but if they were to ever do that, I could just see the country going into a complete shitstorm, and it would
any leadership from Texas that would say, you know what, it's time for us to be our own state, it would just or be our own country. They don't realize, and I work in chemical shipping, and I ship a lot internationally. They don't realize how much they have to subside upon goods and services from other states. Now that would be a different country. There has to be just to logistically get the goods that they need that they're not thinking of would be nightmarish. Just trying to cross the border from Oklahoma into Texas would be, you know, there's so many roads that there's no way for them to patrol the border. There's a lot of border there to begin with. International flights is a concern. So, yeah, they could do it,
I don't want to sort of overestimate what I know about the American culture, but wouldn't you just see this? Wouldn't it just be a case where the government would just use their military might to stop it from happening?
Not now, not this time, day and time. No. The PR behind it is too heavy. Like, they couldn't do it. Maybe if it was 100 years ago, they would totally just shoot.
Oh, yeah, they'd absolutely just march in. But now, you know, and not to say that we're not already spread thin with how far throughout the world we are military-wise, but no, they wouldn't do a military thing. But they would say, okay, Texas, you're your own country, and now we have sanctions that don't allow us to send you anything to you.
Yeah, they would.
And Texas would go, ooh, that was a bad choice. So right. They would just do it diplomatically.
So they would use other forms of power then,
absolutely.
In the terms of money and yeah, goods and services.
Right. But I mean, in the Quebec side of it, if Texas wanted to speak Spanish and the rest of the country had to learn Spanish because Texas wanted to know it, like Quebec, right? They're primarily French speaking, and everybody in Canada gets double labels for everything in English and in French because Quebec wants everything that way. It's like they give away cards at GPs, right?
Right.
There won't be one for GP Montreal.
Right, because it can't be in both languages.
Because they have to be able to have it in English and in French.
Right.
So there won't be one. They won't just give you a French one. It has to be in English and in French by, I guess there's some Quebec law that says it has to be that way. So there won't be promo cards for GP Montreal.
Yeah, because...
It's so infuriating to me
in the rest of Canada, we're obliged to have French labels, and in Quebec, they're obliged to have English labels. So, yeah.
But, I mean, GP Vancouver probably gave away cards because they don't have to have them in French.
Yeah, it's like I said, I don't pretend to understand all this. It's very complex and I'm just a regular human being, right? So I have just the ground floor take on things. But there's definitely a lot of culture difference. It's not like, you know, guys like me are sitting out here and, you know, fuck the French and we hate you guys.
Right.
You know, I don't hate individuals. I hate the politics of it.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, there's plenty of that within the U.S. as well. Just having the two-party system lately has been, we don't care about the politics. Our entire agenda is to do the opposite of the other guy.
Right, right. So that happens no matter where you live, right? Every place has got their own issues. But I definitely think, you know, from a culture and food point of view, when you guys are out there in Montreal, you need to just drink it in because it is a very unique area. And I regret that I can't go because I would like to go out there and spend some time.
I'd love to go. Yeah, it'll be the closest I get to France in my lifetime. You know.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm not going to France. I get to try all their good stuff and their
Foie
gras and the nice good stuff. Yeah.
Well, like,
I can't even get foie gras in Chicago. It's illegal.
It's interesting how much the culture is even different between like Quebec and France, because like I have a cousin who lives in Quebec and she speaks, you know, fluent French, and she's currently traveling in France and Paris and different places, and she's actually a chef, so she's consuming, you know, their culture there.
Mm-hmm.
But she was commenting that she gets asked quite often if she's Quebec, you know, French, because clearly her French isn't the same as their French.
Well, yeah, it's like a
dialect.
You know, Mexican Spanish versus Spanish. It's a different dialect.
Right.
Same over broad, you know, English and American English.
Yeah.
You know, even, you know, American English and Canadian English are different languages. So.
True enough.
And there's plenty of that within the United States. Lots and lots of places.
True enough. So, I mean, let's segue right into the food culture thing, because I know Marcel is, you know, he's got a rep. You know, after GP Vegas,
if I had never seen those pictures, I would have been happy.
Everyone was talking about Marcel's meat at Vegas. And not just because he had his pants down.
So,
Marcel, you're a bit of a foodie?
Oh, for sure, indeed. I love my food. Food is definitely one of my passions in life.
Cool. It's something you got to do every day. You might as well enjoy it, right?
Is your brother a chef, or does he work for a place?
My brother doesn't. My sister, actually, she does now. She's the professional chef in the family.
Okay.
But my family, my dad, he's always cooked. He always liked cooking and eating and everything. So we grew up basically in a culinary family.
Nice.
Nothing professional, but we always had, you know, we were always eating something different that, you know, we didn't like as kids, but looking back later on, I'm like, wow, we had some good food back then, you know?
Right. Yeah, nobody as a kid likes to be forced to eat that sort of culinary stuff that nowadays you'd be like, man, yeah, we were so lucky to be exposed to that early.
Exactly. You just don't realize it.
Yeah, the food I had growing up was not good, so I don't have to worry. The food now is much better than what I got to grow up with, so... But on the subject of food and being a foodie, what is the best individual bite of food you've had in your life? Not meal, because what my understanding of food is, a chef will say all you need is that first bite, because everyone after that's the same. So you have to have that amazing first flavor. What's the best one you've ever had?
I guess I'll pull one. I could say there's several. The best individual flavor on non restaurant on a basic level, I think, is maybe a crispy piece of pepperoni on a perfect pizza with garlic that's just roasted just enough, and you know, mm-hmm. the bread's slightly charred, and like the pepperoni is a little crispy on top, that has got it like that brown there, and it's got that crunch when you bite in.
Yep.
Like that to me, that's a good lowbrow. That's like a perfect lowbrow just taste right there. But as far as like high fine dining, I went to this one place called Atelier Crean, and they had all this fancy, you know, like food is art stuff, but the food was excellent. Yep. And, there was this cold soup that was, it was like a cold pea soup, but it was it wasn't like split pea soup consistently. It was very thin, but a slightly thick, kind of syrupy. And then there's like a carrot. They had like a sorbet. So it was basically a carrot sorbet that was in there along with like a cream. So it was like two creams. Then you dipped in there and you got it. So it was like a cold soup. And you dipped in it. The flavors, like you could taste everything, was individually clean and fresh and delicious and just melted together. And it was like, it doesn't seem like much, but it is just amazing.
Yeah. That's awesome. I was trying to think of I enjoy food quite a lot. Being in Chicago, we have a very, very, very diverse culinary backdrop to choose from. And I think, as ridiculous as it is, I'm pretty sure the individual best flavor I've ever had was just a perfectly cooked, size of my fist, and I'm not a small man, filet mignon.
Okay.
From just, it was just a little, my wife and I like to go out to a place in Northwest Illinois called Galena, and it was a restaurant that wasn't even there for very long. And I got, you know, steak and crab cakes, and she got a cedar plank salmon with like praline on it. Everything was spectacular, but it's the first steak that I had in my life that I could accurately describe as melting in my mouth, literally. It was the absolute perfect, because I love me some steak. That's my go-to food. So when it's done perfectly, and I'm not the biggest filet fan because it doesn't have much fat, so it doesn't have a whole lot of flavor. But this one was cooked medium rare, perfect. Perfect. And, I mean, it was a baseball-sized piece of meat. And it was just, it's the only steak I've ever had in my life that I would ascribe the word perfect to. It is, if I could just have that first bite, that would be the bite that I chose for all my meals. It was just unbelievable. And again, it's filet. It's like, this isn't a ribeye. Why am I enjoying this steak so much? It was just absolutely perfect.
So how long ago was this?
This was, oh, Christ, maybe 8-9 years.
And you describe it like it was yesterday.
The power of food. You know
what? Yeah, no kidding.
The only thing I remember about that meal, I don't remember the crab cakes. I know I tasted my wife's salmon, and it was very good, and she loved it because she is huge on fish. But that steak was perfect, and that restaurant had a cocktail. The restaurant has since moved in that town, and they changed their menu to more local, so they don't have that incredible steak anymore. But they kept their cocktail menu, and it was called a deep, dark mojito. It's the only place in the world that I've seen it. It's basically a classic mojito, which, for people who don't know, is muddled mint, lime, and sugar, and then you pour rum and soda over it, usually like club soda, not lemon lime. Very refreshing, very good. But they went, okay, we have a variety of mojitos. This one is deep dark. Substitute white sugar for brown sugar and white rum for añejo, so aged rum. Hmm. Unbelievable. I mean, I made it to Vegas once, and I went to Mesa Grill, Bobby Flay's restaurant. I went out as part of a work thing, and no one else wanted to go because they were like, it's going to cost $100. Okay, I'm never going to be there again. I'm going to try it. And they said, we can make any cocktail. I said, I want this one. He comes back. He goes, we don't have brown sugar. But we made it with sugar in the raw. So they did a very good job of it. But anywhere else that I ask for, they have absolutely no idea. And I've had places go, we have everything. We even have rose petals. I said, you have brown sugar? No, we don't have brown sugar. Because there's really no cocktails use brown sugar, right? But that cocktail was amazing. And that steak was perfect. So that meal, in and of itself, that's my choice for the best thing I've had. Yes, I know exactly where I was sitting in the restaurant, how it came out of the kitchen, what it looked like on the plate. It was perfect.
Awesome. What about you, Mike? What about what's the best flavor you had?
I mean, I'm a steak man. I got simple pleasures for me, and there was a new restaurant that opened up here. I haven't done a lot of sort of traveling to the big cities and tried the fancy restaurants, but there was a restaurant that opened up here that brought in a very high-end chef for this area, and I was pretty much in the same boat. I mean, I ordered the steak like I always do, and it's just that melt in your mouth, almost can cut it with a fork, just tender and properly seasoned and just simple flavors, but just excellent. I mean, I can almost taste it now, and he was really a great chef, because even my wife had a chicken dish and it was the same way. It was really well done. For me, it would be a tie between that and because we're a coastal community, we get, you know, a lot of fish dishes, and he also cooked up a halibut dish that was just off the hook.
Yeah. I so hate both of you for living in coastal areas, because the one thing we cannot get in the middle of the country is good ocean seafood. We can get lake perch and trout and, you know, freshwater fish. We cannot get, without paying a premium for it, good seafood.
Yeah, like it's a little expensive here. It's not like the old days when I was growing up. You know, if you were even remotely local, you really didn't pay for fish in those days because fishing was such a big industry here. Everyone's freezers were full of salmon and halibut, and yeah, you
Oh,
know, it was
man.
just you couldn't give away enough in those days. Nowadays, it's harder to get, but I can still go. I mean, there are fish plants that operate here. I can still go buy like a whole halibut for reasonable amounts of money and just keep it in my freezer and eat it throughout the winter or whatever.
That's just so it's you said, you know, everyone had it and you couldn't even give it away, and it was probably really like I love sockeye salmon. There's all different kinds, and sockeye is by far my absolute favorite.
And that's our bread and butter out here. When I
Oh,
was
I
growing up,
fucking love sockeye.
it's like the oil fields, right? I mean, that's how everybody made their money in this community in those days. Even myself, like when I was in high school, I mean, I was working in fish canneries during the summer, making ridiculous amounts of money because,
Yeah.
you know, that's what you had to pay. Yeah, even now it's pretty easy to get fish. You have to pay for it, or you really do have to know somebody pretty close to get given some. But yeah, it's not hard to come by where I live.
See that, I think that's a crucial part that a lot of people got to do with your food is like, you know, there's a lot of things that are local to your area, and you know, it's good to get those treats that are foreign, but if you learn how to cook with what you got local and make the best use of it, like you can eat some really exquisite stuff that a lot of other people are jealous of that you may just take advantage of or not make a big deal out of it. But you know, I mean, make the most of it what's local because the prices are right. You're getting some top quality stuff like sockeye salmon out here is just ridiculous. You got to go to Whole Foods and pay something like $20 a pound for fresh, non-farmed, raised, you know, good stuff. And it's like,
That's being landlocked. All we see basically is Atlantic farm-raised salmon, color added, right? That's the only thing that's available. We do have, we got, we did, there's a local grocery store to Chicago called Jewel Osco. They're owned by, I think, Albertsons, which is out west, so you might have heard of them. But they have fairly decent fishmongers for the most part, where they'll bring in wild caught sockeye from time to time. And it's still, you know, it's going to be like $7 for 8 ounces, maybe somewhere in there. But it's just the problem in this area is that Americans don't grow up with very much fish unless you live on the coast. So no one likes how fish tastes. So tilapia is like the thing because it's the consistency of fish without tasting like anything.
Well, that's what halibut is like, right? Halibut isn't really a fishy fish. It takes on whatever you're seasoning it with.
In Chicago, halibut is like I'm trying to think. It'd be like lime juice, right?
Really?
Something that's very strong. They would say halibut has an intense fish flavor here
Really?
because
Really? Whoa.
nobody eats fish. I
Wow.
mean, we are a meat and potatoes area of the world. You'll hear a lot of people from Chicago tout things like no one else knows how to make a hot dog or pizza or whatever. But what we really have that the rest of the country doesn't really understand how to do is Italian beef. Here, it's just a staple. It's something that it's basically a very well spiced roast beef that is shaved and you make sandwiches out of it, usually served with its own au jus.
And peppers,
And
right? Onions.
well, you can we use a jardinera. I don't know how familiar this is everywhere else. It's basically a vegetable blend with like serrano peppers.
Oh yeah, I saw that on Anthony Bourdain. That's yeah, it
Oh
was
yeah,
terrible.
see, I haven't traveled enough to know what is available from Chicago everywhere else, but here, even a pretty crappy restaurant will have a fairly decent Italian beef. And my understanding is from people who have traveled from Chicago, they can't find an even passable one anywhere else in the country. And I would think maybe New York would have a good Italian beef, but
Well, I guess.
it's just surprising that how regional the cuisine within the US even is. Like I'll travel, I've been to like Florida a couple times, and you get off the plane and there's a Pizzeria Uno in the airport there, and it's like that's not even the good pizza from Chicago. Why are they in the airport? Like, I wouldn't eat there, but other people might go, oh, they have Chicago pizza here, let's try it.
But I think that goes back to Marcel's point about just finding out what your area excels at, because clearly, I mean, you're talking about Italian beef as a staple, whereas obviously fish is a staple where I'm at. I mean, mm-hmm. I can literally, I was talking earlier about how it's 150 miles between communities here. If I drive about half that distance along that highway, I can literally step off the road and catch my own salmon. Whenever you drive that highway, there are fishermen standing there with their poles catching sockeye salmon. Jesus. You know, literally 100 feet off the road.
Is it to the point where you really don't want to have another dish of sockeye salmon?
No, I don't get it enough for it to be that. Because frankly, I'm not much as far as fishing goes. I find it not relaxing at all. But you know, the option is there. I can go do that. You know, if I owned a small boat, I could go out. Not very far outside our harbor and catch salmon. I can catch halibut, you know, or I can tag along, you know, pay somebody's gas money and tag along on their boat or whatever. Like it's just so common here. Like you won't find people that haven't tried it. And the rare people who haven't, just that's by their choice. Right. So yeah, it's all about local but I wanted to get back. We were talking a little bit about steak specifically, and I think that's a great topic to tackle, you know, from a podcast point of view, because maybe, you know, we can help educate some of the listeners on how to make a good steak. I think we got Marcel here. I think he can probably help us out with, you know, how do you prepare a basic steak so that, you know, it maybe takes it up a notch from, you know, just slapping it on a pan at home.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you start, Marcel? You'd probably start with, you know, basically making sure you get a good cut of meat.
Yeah, it's all about the cut of meat. I've learned, like, I've had a good, nice ribeye that was not the best cut of it. I mean, yeah, a nice ribeye that was like a select cut, and, you know, I like it. It tastes good. But when you get a prime, and I got it a couple times in my life, I don't like to spend that money. It's a whole nother ball game.
Man.
Like, it's a complete nother ball game.
For people who are unfamiliar, it's select, choice, prime. And I think prime is 2% of total beef, and it's basically fat content throughout the muscle. So if you go to your local restaurant, they might say choice, but most likely they're buying select because it's inexpensive. So an 8-ounce filet choice might be a $12 steak. The prime one's going to be $25. So for people who don't understand the difference in the price between choice and prime, it's get a second mortgage on your house, enjoy that meal, because prime meat is, it's like it's not even beef. It's hard to describe how dramatically different prime beef is from anything else.
I bought Costco. I don't know if you guys have Costco. They got a decent price on prime sometimes. You could get it. It's somewhere below 20 a pound, so it's not bad. So I got that. I cooked it on the barbecue. I burnt the meat. Because there's so much fat, I didn't know how to handle that fat content on there. And I was like, damn, this, you know, I just burnt the meat. Ate the meat. It was delicious. it'll make up for whatever, you know, you fuck up on. So you got room for error.
Interesting. But yeah,
the benefits there.
For regular human beings, you know, that can't afford the high end, obviously, you know, ribeye is probably where you want to land.
Yeah. So steaks.
If you're familiar with cooking it, absolutely. You have to remember ribeye is two muscles. If you get it with the chain on, so it's not going to cook. Those two pieces cook at different rates. So part of it's going to be like medium, and the other part's going to be charcoal. It's a very difficult cut, at least for me.
I think ribeye is actually the best cut in my opinion.
It's by far the best flavor. Love ribeye.
So again, when you get steaks, you got the ribeye, which is there's debate between ribeye and the New York as the top choice, and you know some people have their own. And then there's the T-bone or the porterhouse, which is basically a T-bone would be the New York, and then it has an extra little flap of meat on the side and the bone right there, which is a T-bone. And then the porterhouse adds that flap if you extend it out and that meat was there. That's the filet mignon. That was cut out, so the porterhouse will actually have a little piece of the filet on the steak itself.
Yep.
Yeah, because I think a lot of people just assume that the T-bone is the way to go.
Well, if you're ordering T-bone, like Marcel said, you're getting basically and for people in New York, it's called the Kansas City steak. So if you're sitting there going, what in the world is a New York strip steak? It's Kansas. I don't know why it's called Kansas City in New York, and everywhere else calls it New York. But some places might call it a Delmonico because that's the restaurant that popularized it. Yeah, it depends on where on the cow. Part of it is porterhouse and part of it is T-bone. The further down the – why is it failing me? It's the filet, but the filet is which muscle?
No, yeah, but no, like the porter, the T-bone would be like a little flap, an indented flap, whereas the porterhouse
like
would be
it's like the convex and concave.
It's like a convex and concave against the bone, basically, with the meat part.
Right, right.
Yeah, so porterhouse is very expensive. But yes, what you'll notice is Marcel did not say sirloin, because in steak circles, sirloin doesn't exist. It's not a very good cut of meat.
No.
Go ahead, Marcel.
No, sirloin. But they're strong for skirt steak, flank steak, which is very flavor. Those are some of my favorite steaks. And I mean, you can make. I've had a good sirloin, so it's not impossible. And I'm not saying we're not talking bad about it, but you know, if you want to start with a steak, you want to really like
sirloin's the cheapest.
Yeah.
Of the quote unquote steak cuts of meat.
I mean, I would highly recommend people give a good ribeye a chance. Mm-hmm. That's really. For me, that's what I can afford. Sort of, you know, when I go looking for a good steak, and like you said, the flavor is there, but you just got to be a little careful how you cook it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, as far as like the choices and the prime, I don't know if we illustrated this, but it's like the fat content. For people that don't know, the more fat on your steak, the better it is. And I don't mean like, you know, gristle fat. It's like the streaks of fat inside the meat. Because what that does is it gives flavor to the meat when you cook it down. So a prime will have a lot of streaks.
So
you can find a good. Yeah, it melts as you cook it. So you can find a select choice, you know, a lower cut of meat that'll have more fat in there. If you go through the packs of meat, you know, like at your grocery store, and you'll see it. So you want to try to find the ones that have more of the fat in there, and it'll always come out with a better steak. So,
yeah, and I think it's really important to, you know, make that distinction. It's, you know, you're not talking about, like you said, the gristle, big bands of fat around the outside.
Yeah, you're not looking for the big white band of fat around it. It's the pieces of fat within the muscle.
Within the muscle, and within the meat itself.
The more of it there is, the better that steak's going to be. And if you see one, I mean, for people who are kind of maybe learning all of this, go to Google Image Search and put in Wagyu, W-A-G-Y-U, or Kobe beef, and look what those steaks look like. They're called white steak for a reason. And
yes,
they
I
cost
had some.
$100 a steak for a reason. I've had some as well. It's as much as prime is different than choice, Wagyu is, I mean, even the ground beef is $40 a pound for a reason.
Yes. There's a food convention that I just went to in January. I go to every year. I've been went for 6 years. So Japan's represented, and they had Wagyu beef, and like just seeing it in person, like it's just more white. I got pictures on Twitter. I'll probably retweet it.
I love those pictures you put up. I was just like, man, that's one of the benefits of being, you know, in a large city is just having access to conventions like that. And I was just like drooling at the stuff you were posting.
Yeah, so people, the misconception, the number one misconception, it comes with the cut of beef. So when you start with a better cut of beef, and there's another thing I want to get to. We're going in scatterbrain circles, but
yeah.
People are going to get the point. Is beef ultimately? I don't want to be, you know, philosophical, but beef is not necessarily the most healthiest food that you want to eat, and it's better for your body if you eat less red meats. Ultimately, doctors just recommend it's good for your health just in general. So just it's part of your diet. You should try to cut out as much red meat as possible. So the benefit to that is if you eat less steaks and stuff, when you do eat a steak, you'll spend the extra money to get a good steak. Mm-hmm. So that way, when you do eat steak, that you eat top quality, it's better for your body. You get a better flavor. You get a better experience. So, I mean, I could ultimately say that's my ultimate suggestion to people. If you think that steaks are too expensive, just eat less red meat. And when you do, just go for a higher quality. And mm-hmm. I think you'll appreciate it in the long run.
Yeah, that's what my wife and I do. We almost eat no beef at home. We might have ground beef for like tacos. And that's it. You know, we're primarily the lean, you know, pork and chicken, things along that line, fish. And then when we go to a restaurant, it's not, let's get this steak. It's, that's when I'm going, they've got that 24-ounce porterhouse. Let's see if I can finish it again.
So we've got our good cut of beef. We brought it home. You know, what are we doing with this thing?
Hold on. Hold on one second.
Well, I can start while he's doing that. I can tell you what I would do. One is, unless it's winter, and even if it is and it's not snowing, it should be going on a grill. If you're good with the charcoal grill and I'm not, do it that way. I have a gas grill because I'm bad with charcoal. So,
well, and I think most people own gas grills nowadays. It's just a convenience factor more than anything.
Well, yeah, it's ready to go a lot faster. Well, if you have a chimney starter, you can get a charcoal grill going at about the same time as heating the gas grill. But the gas grill, just generally speaking, they've got more surface area. You've got better control over the heat once you have it going. Whatever. But make sure you get your meat to room temperature before you put it on the grill.
Well, that's so there you go. That's a good point. You know, you don't want to take it right out of the freezer and stick it on there. And
no, you will have a very, very well done outside and a very, 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 very rare inside. And see, as far as seasoning for me is maybe some olive oil, salt, and pepper. That's it.
You got this guy. He's a genius right here. Yeah. I mean, really, good steak. You could.
See, I love my steak. I love it.
Yeah, if you got the right amount of it, salt and pepper is all you need because the fat will just flavor the steak. Olive oil, yeah, just give it a crisp, or you could do butter. A lot of steakhouses use butter, and butter is a secret. If you want to make any steak taste better, just put a little pat of butter on it, let it melt down, and all of a sudden your steak tastes a bit better.
And we're talking real butter.
Things anyway, yes.
We're talking actual butter.
Margarine's not going to do it. You need to, and probably use unsalted, because you probably put some extra salt on there already. Mm-hmm. And don't use table salt, use kosher salt, and crack your black pepper. Don't just dump it out of the little red and white thing.
Yeah, little steps.
People don't think that it makes a difference. I have salt and I have pepper. It's not the same.
Let's take a step back for a second. We were talking about the meat being at room temperature, and I think we obviously said you just don't take it out of the freezer and throw it. But I mean, you also shouldn't just take it out of the fridge either, because it's still going to be chilled from the fridge. You know, you want to let it get to room temperature beforehand.
Yes, and I've heard different school of thought that if you want a more rare steak and you want a more of a charred outer, you don't bring it up to room temperature because you have less chance to overcook the inside of the meat by that time that the outside gets to the desired texture that you want. So if you're looking for more of a rare steak, room temperature is less of a thing. But if you want a nice medium, or a medium rare, and you want it perfect, then you want to bring it to room temperature, at least for like a half hour, about a half hour roughly.
Yeah.
Right.
And Marcel brings up a good point there. A lot of people are going to say, well, how do I want my steak cooked? And you see a lot of humorous things that will say, okay, there's rare, there's medium rare, there's medium, and then everything else is a waste of your money. I prefer medium rare for just about anything. Some meats, lamb, for instance, there's rare and then there's, I'm wasting my money. So it is a taste preference. You might not enjoy the texture of the meat as much if it's medium rare or rare, but the less you cook the meat, the more the flavor you get.
Yeah, I like,
that's your trade-off.
Me, myself, when I grew up as a kid, I liked well done.
Me too. I hated steak when I was a kid. Ugh.
I hated red. Red to me was too chewy. I didn't like dealing with it. To me, and there's a lot of people that don't like it. The black community, actually, a lot of people don't like their meat red in any shape, form, or fashion. It's growing up in Oakland, a lot of people don't like that. But ultimately, honestly, if you like well done, just slowly work your way to red in your meat. And when you get to like medium rare, medium to medium rare is when you want to target. If you do medium, it makes a steak just that much better.
Really, yeah, because I'm the kind of guy, like, I'm not, I just don't like the any redness in the meat. And that's, I mean, I grew up with like leather steaks because my old man was adamant there would be no red in any steak he ever cooked. So, I mean, he overcooked everything. But when I got older and was able to take over and do it my own way, I mean, I find I have to be, I'm very cognizant of where it is in the cooking process, because if I can get it to the point where there's still, you know, some red left in it, and I take it out, you know, off the heat and let it rest. By the time I get to consume it, you know, it's just right. Like, I'm on that fine edge between red and no red.
So you're going for, like, medium well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I know that I don't want to dry it out, but on the other hand, I'm just not a fan of having, you know, any kind of red in my meat.
And Mike brings up another good point. You don't cook. So medium is 160 degrees. Don't cook it on the grill until it's 160 degrees because it's by the time you eat it, because you have to let it rest, it's going to be medium well. Cook it to medium rare at 150. Let it rest. It's going to come up to medium, and you'll be just fine.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, so if you go back to sort of walking our way through the process, I mean, one of the other keys is obviously the temperature of your grill. Like, don't just fire it up, throw the steak on 2 seconds later, and then watch it,
the outside cook, right?
You know, you want your barbecue to get, you know, nice and heated to the temperature that you want it, so that you're controlling that temperature and it's not, you know, it's not controlling you, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You want it hot. You want to get that sear. That sear is important. That's the most important part about a steak. You don't want it to sit there and steam in itself. If your temperature is just hot enough to cook the steak and it's not getting the char, it's going to steam in its own juices and it's going to be like a boiled steak. You can also do it on, I do like a cast iron pan. I think that's that, and also a broiler. Like, as far as steaks, if you, those are the three options. You got grill, you got cast iron, and you got a broiler. Anything else is just, you can't do it.
Yeah, because I'm at the point right now where I'm doing mine in a cast iron just because we had a big storm that destroyed my barbecue that was outside.
Oh, that's so good.
So, you know, I'll be purchasing another one come this summer. But so I'm left with the cast iron way. But you know what? As long as you're careful, and again, you know, you control your heat properly, it can be just as good. You just, you know, you just got to be careful.
Yeah, there, if you've never used a cast iron skillet to cook a steak, be extremely careful, because if you have smoke detectors anywhere in your house, the first time you use it, they will be going off.
And there's a website I recommend you check out. It's called Chef's Steps. It's basically these guys, they got free videos on how you could do different things of cooking and whatnot. And they got a good video on how to cook a steak. And they use the butter in a certain way in the pan that you use it to baste the steak as you do it. Maybe have a sprig of thyme in there or something. And it gives it this flavor. I've tried it. And it really is. It's a benefit. I kind of like the cast iron just because of the ease. You don't have to fire up the grill, and just because you can do that. So I've been kind of doing more cast iron steaks myself, even though a steak on the grill to me is like the ultimate.
Oh, so. Yeah. I'm the same way. Like, there's no replacing the grill, and I, like, you know, I'm jonesing for my grill all winter long here. But, you know, sometimes maybe you live in an apartment, you know, you can't have a grill or whatever, you know, doing it on the cast iron is a way to go. And I'll make sure I find the link for that Chef Steps website, and I'll post it in the show notes so everybody can check that out.
Yeah. Marcel, we have a question for you from Tommy Moles. Other than we already answered the first one, which is the best thing you've ever tasted. I guess that's different than what you said. But anyway, he says, what is your best dish to cook?
I got a lot. That's a hard question to ask. It depends on what day of the week. But I could say recently I cooked a salmon that I particularly liked. I just I got this machine, a sous vide, basically. You could cook it in water.
Yeah,
So I got that going, basically. Card Nexus, he got me on that. So I use that to get the salmon to the right texture, then cook it on a cast iron grill, give it a nice char, put that on a celery root, which is basically...
Yeah.
Celery root is awesome. It's like a mashed potato, but it's just so much more flavor. So it's so good. But it's cheap also.
Yeah, if anyone's listening to this in England, which I would doubt, they're very, very familiar with celery root there. It's a bit more new and eclectic here.
Yeah, I mean, but there's celery everywhere. So if you live in like a farm state, you can find celery root. And if you like mashed potatoes, you are completely upgrading your potatoes by doing a celery root instead. Like, you just don't know what you're doing without it. It's like, it's just insane. And then I had some kale. And I mean, that's a recent meal that I just felt was just on par. It was just 100%. It was a pesto sauce on the salmon, throw a little bit of toasted pine nuts. It just does something for it. And yeah.
So let's just go back to the steak here for a second, because we got to make sure that make sure whoever's following this along isn't like, oh my God, how do I finish this off? So we sort of brushed by it very quickly, but one thing, you know, once you've sort of gotten your meat cooking and, you know, you've controlled your temperature and you know how you like it, I think I mentioned it earlier, and just make sure you understand that when you take the meat off the grill or out of the pan, it's still going to cook for a certain amount of time. Yes. Before you consume it. Like, you want to let it rest.
Yes. You do not.
Unless you want a messy plate. Yeah.
No, don't. Whatever you do, I don't care what your steak is, you're going to spend 5 at the absolute minimum to about 8 to 10, depending.
Yep.
To let your steak rest. Your steak comes out juicier, tastier, better every time. It may be counterproductive. You're like, I want it hot. I want it good. You don't. You ultimately don't, you know. You can have half your steak, try it that way, and then try the other half. Even though once you cut into it, you're going to lose all the juices. So that goes mute. Cut your steak in half. Do that. Cut your steak in half before you cook it.
And then cook it. Yeah, do both ways. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then try that one hot off the grill, see how you like it, and then wait the other one for 10 minutes and see how you like it better that way.
Yeah, no, it seems kind of crazy to somebody who doesn't know how to cook a steak, but yeah, you got to let it sit there, like you said, at least 5 minutes.
Because what's happening is all the heat is causing the proteins of the meat, the fibers, to contract, and it basically squeezed out all the juices. So the juices are there; it's sitting in the steak because you got there. Once you cut into it, all the juices will escape out, basically. But you got the char holding it in. When you let the steak rest, you know, the temperature releases, and then the fibers, they ease up, and they start absorbing back the juices, the blood, and everything that makes the steak taste so good. So you just give it that time, and basically that's the simple science behind it, letting your meat rest.
So you're letting it rest, like, on the counter, in the oven?
On the counter.
Off the heat.
Yeah, you could put it on the barbecue on the off side of the grill with the cover off. Right. You could put it in the oven, or you could put it in the microwave. I would put it on a grate. So you don't let because if you don't, then the juices will steam and you'll ruin the crispy crust on the bottom if you let it just sit there on like a plate. So I tend to leave it elevated like on like a cookie rack or something like that.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah, because otherwise it'll just soak in there and it'll be, you won't get that char that you like. It'll just be all soggy.
Yeah, exactly. It's not horrible, but it's just so much better when you don't have that.
Yeah, we're talking about taking it to
a... If you put in the work to do it to that point, don't, on the very last step, don't undo some of the work you've done.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And hopefully people, even somebody that says, oh, I know how to cook a steak, maybe they can get a few hints how to take theirs to the next level out of this.
Yeah, I usually do mine's like 4 minutes aside. I've found that gives me like, it's more rare, like so medium rare. I found like for like an inch steak or something, or a little bit less than an inch. But somewhere in that range gets you a nice steak. Over that, like you go to 10 minutes, you're definitely going to be in the well-done range. So that gives you an idea of how long you want to cook your steak.
Yeah.
On the low end, you could do 6 minutes. So
of course, knowing that every grill and oven top is a little different temperature-wise, I mean, you got to get to know your own equipment, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, while you're learning to do it, an instant read thermometer is your best friend. Once you get to know it, you get to learn the... You know, it feels like this when it's rare. It feels like this. You just basically push down on it, and you go, okay, now this is medium rare. This is what medium feels like.
That's why I'm going to miss my barbecue so much because, I mean, man, it's like we had a relationship. I mean, yeah. I knew exactly how long to put the meat on. I didn't have to time it. I just, yep, it's, you know, oh, okay, time to flip it. You know, like, man, I knew everything about that grill, and now it's, you know, the weather destroyed it. I have to get... It's like a new relationship. I got to start dating another grill now.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a way you can do it. The toughness, if you touch your, like, I believe your pinky. There's a video out there. I'm going to find out, give you a link. But there's, like, if you touch your index finger, you touch your middle finger, you touch your pointer finger, and then there's, like, the flap of meat on the inside between. You got to see the video, but it gives you an idea of what the texture of what that certain doneness is. Mm-hmm. So once you get used to how that feels, the firmness of the meat, then you can know when to pull your meat off, and then you get the perfect, you know, the perfect cookness that you're looking for.
And you're not, once you learn, you're not sticking it with a meat thermometer because, like, not letting it rest, all that's letting out juices is out. Juices.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll let you know what the temperature is, but that little piece of that steak, you're basically sacrificing just to know if it's done.
Yeah. So, I mean, hopefully somebody out there has now taken their stake to a whole new level thanks to this, because there really is, you know, some tricks of the trade to getting a good steak cooked.
It's one of those skills that a lot of people, once they learn, they go, why am I going to the steakhouse? Why am I paying $25 for the steak? I can go, and now I know what to look for. I can go pick out four steaks for that same $25, feed my family this awesome meal
for half
all,
the price,
all the stuff, everything. And then, you know, and like Marcel was saying earlier, then when you want to go out for steak, you go, I'm not going to that old place. I'm going to that place that says, we have prime ribeye. And it's going to be a $60 steak, and you're going to go, this is the one I can't make at home, so I'm going to have it in a restaurant.
Yep. Yeah.
And I think it's a really great way to, you know, if you're a young guy out there on the prowl, it's a great way to impress your lady when you can cook, man.
Yeah, and then you need to learn how to pair with it. So
yeah,
you might want your Miller Lite, but
I mean, in my family, nobody cooks steak but me, because my wife is just like, I you know, I can't cook it as well as you do, and we love your steak. And I'm like, well, I got my niche, you know.
Yep.
I'm valuable.
Yeah,
it's good to have that go-to, to know that, you know, you can think about it throughout the week, right? Thursday night, I'm making steak.
Yeah.
I go through all the process, you know, and do all that. And everyone's got their own little thing. Like, some people will. The other thing is, if you want grill marks, don't sit there and flip the meat 900 times. Put it on the grill, wait for the proteins to release, rotate it once, let it get up to that 4 minutes, 5 minutes mark, flip it, and do the exact same thing again. Leave it alone. Let it sit there and cook.
Yeah.
You don't need to be in there playing with it to make sure that every little thing gets in there. It can do it all on its own.
Yeah.
But I stand there and, yeah.
Yeah, steak flip once, and you don't touch it after. I usually, yep. I don't care about grill marks. I put the steak on, and I flip it, and then I'm done. And the difference I learned with the prime, like, you know, you want to get your char and then maybe move it off to an indirect heat to finish cooking it. But, you know, other than that, basically, that's fine.
Yeah. What I like about the whole cooking of a steak is that it's so easy to learn. Like, you can come off as somebody who really knows how to cook by cooking a good steak, and it really isn't that hard.
You don't need 100 different, you know, herbs, and I need to use this particular type of whatever. I mean, you already have salt and pepper and probably at least vegetable oil if you want it to cook just that tiny bit faster. That's all you need. And if anyone ever tells you that putting salt on a steak before you cook it, it will dry it out, they don't know what they're talking about.
No, there's scientific fact. I got a book that's Cooks Illustrated. They do like a scientific process behind, you know, food and whatnot, and they did both sides, and they're mute. You can't really taste the taste difference. You could put it pre-salted beforehand, you could salt it right before it goes on the grill, and it's going to be indistinguishable between the two. You know, you're just going to find your way to skin the cat, and you're going to have your own way when you figure it out and boil it down. So that's what it is. Now, if you got, say, like a less choice cut of meat and you want to add more than salt and pepper, I do recommend a granulated onion. Is particularly very good when you mix it into the mix. I did use granulated garlic before, but if you're cooking directly hot heat, I find that
burns.
Yeah, it burns, so that's not as good if you're doing it directly. But if you're doing your steak, maybe a different style, I found that more indirect, and that's more of a roast, the garlic is really good. So something to incorporate later. Thyme is a great flavor with steaks, as is garlic. You can mix that in with the butter and, you know, baste your steak with that. Delicious. Those are great ways to add your steak and take it to the next level. Another thing is like a compound butter. Basically, you take butter, you chop up, say, some shallots, or you chop up some garlic and some other herbs, parsley or, you know, thyme or something. You just make a pat of butter that you put on your steak afterwards and let it melt. And, like, that just transforms your steak into something else. It's a good way to impress those girls also. So, you know. There's little things you can do to just take the steak to the next level, and it's not just a steak that you're making, you know, little add-ons.
So. Yeah, those are especially good to know if you need to dress up, you know, a lesser steak as well. I mean, you can add a lot of flavor to a cheaper steak.
Yeah, do it in the cooking process. Don't do it with A1. If you need steak sauce, you didn't have a good steak to begin with.
Yeah, but if you got a bad steak, A1 does help. So
If you have a bad steak, A1 is necessary. You're just like, you know what? I need some of this raisin paste, whatever else is in it, right?
I like A1. It's good, but yeah, if you got a good steak, don't even think about putting A1 near it.
If you're used to, I need steak with A1, do what we have just taught you to do, and then try it, and then you go, you'll realize that A1 is for, you didn't know how to make a steak before. You didn't know how to prepare it properly.
And if you don't like that big fancy steak without the A1, then don't buy the fancy steak. Like, you would be just as happy with the lesser cut and the A1. You'll probably get the same experience for less the money. So, you know, it's up to you what you want to do with your taste preference.
But I would hope that, you know, at least give it a try, you know, try it our way. See if you like it. You might find that, you know, you've got a whole new way of cooking steak, and it doesn't have to be all the time. But every now and then, you know, cook your lady a special steak for your anniversary or whatever, you know. Big hit.
Yep.
Cooking that beef steak.
Nothing like it. Pair it with a nice Pinot Noir, maybe a Merlot if you have a tomato side dish. Spectacular.
So I was looking at Josh, you put up, you know, asking for some questions and stuff. I see in fine form, Kevy had a question about how many different dishes Marcel knows how to cook out of weed.
Quite a few, I guess. Because basically weed is, the THC qualities is soluble in oils. Mm-hmm. So that's what people make with their edibles, or their edibles are basically weed treats, cookies, or whatever. And so you can put that into butter and, say, olive oil, and so basically anything you cook with butter and olive oil you can have infused with weed. So that basically the possibilities are endless. I could say, like, one that really got me, I did it with olive oil, and then I made a pasta, and then I drove to class. It didn't kick in until I got, you know, I was at class, and then I walked into class, and I could say that was probably the most intense experience I've ever had eating anything. I was just plastered like I was on a roller coaster. The teacher was looking at me. People were looking at me. I didn't care.
Interesting.
It was insane.
Well, I may have to hit you up at some point because my old man has got some issues and may be on some legal marijuana here pretty soon. So I was discussing with him some options as far as cooking it and doing it that way. So I may hit you up for some ideas at some point.
Yes, the best way. Anyone that I think that's going through a medical, there's certain ones that are better for the way that they could take it. And smoking is could be harsh on people's lungs. So yeah, if eating it, I've my friend's mom, she recently had to do it for medical reasons, and she eats it all the time, and it works perfectly for her. She loves it. It doesn't interfere with her lifestyle at all. So
yeah, I think. Well, my dad, you know, used to be a smoker and quit. So I think he's a little, he doesn't want to go back to smoking anything. So, you know, I was going through with him the different options that I could even just, you know, Google quickly as far as some things that we could do with it. And he was, you know, pretty interested in that. So interesting. It's good to hear that there's lots of options out there for cooking it.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Like he said, basically unlimited, right?
Yeah.
Basically unlimited. I've seen it all. I mean, someday when it gets legal, there's going to be a restaurant that's all edible stuff. And, like, I don't know. I'm actually kind of aversive against the edibles because, man, it gets you stoned. Like, people underestimate
it. Yeah, you're using all of it because the temperature is lower, right? That's my understanding of it. I've never done anything with it, but my understanding is when you're physically burning it, the temperature is destroying part of the necessary chemical. And when you cook with it, it's a lot less.
Well, that's part of it. And it's also the absorption. I think the way that absorbs through your body when you ingest it is completely different way instead of going through your lungs and entering the bloodstream that way. And so it just has a heavier feel. So a lot of people that try it for the first time, I've seen a lot of people get sick off of it. So don't underestimate them. People come... Mm-hmm. You know, you go to Colorado and Washington, and now that it's legal and you can go there, I just say, be careful, people, because more people have problems over the edibles, not necessarily like drunk driving problems, stuff like that, but you're just going to be floored and you're going to have a bad, miserable time. So be careful about that, you know.
It's an interesting time with the legalization sort of catching on in certain places, and I mean even here in Canada we're really struggling with that. I've been paying a little more attention to it since my dad's been ill, and even here in Canada, although you can get it, you can get a prescription for it, it's quite apparent that the government doesn't actually like it. Like, they were forced to do it because of the Supreme Court of Canada overturned some rulings and stuff. So they're being drag kicking and screaming into this. And so it's, it's an interesting, interesting time that, it's becoming legal in different areas, and some more so than others. But,
I think ultimately it's going to take a few years for the stigma to go away, but people are going to realize this is less of a social scourge that people have, made it out to be. And if you look into the history behind why marijuana has been prohibited, is there's a lot of racist agendas that are being pushed, and you really dig into it, you can see how messed up it is and how many people are actually in jail for marijuana offenses that are just not really that big of a deal. Like, I can understand other drugs can really just take a person there, and people say marijuana is the gateway drug, but ultimately alcohol is the gateway drug to it. Everything. Like,
right.
You talk to most dope fiends, they do whatever they do and they drink alcohol, maybe cigarettes, and that's basically their cup of tea.
Yeah, and it's really interesting when you start digging into it, the actual reasoning behind a lot of the ban or the prohibition on this over the years, and just the lack of science behind it, that it's it's all political and social, and there really is no good reason behind it. And we're at a point now where, your interest in it might vary between, social use and medical use, but hopefully we're headed towards a time when socially it's just more accepted. Because, I look at my dad, for instance, he's stuck between, if he doesn't go and start using marijuana as a pain relief, his only option are much, much harder and more addictive drugs.
Yeah, it's probably, opiates and codeine.
Oh, yeah.
And
well, he'll be on Oxy if he's not trying other things, right?
And yeah,
he's already gone down that road where he had to use it for a brief time after a knee operation, and basically took it back and told the doctor to shove it because he could could feel how addictive that was, right? And so, he's been sort of complaining lately, and I said to him, I said, all kidding aside, you need to go see your doctor about this, getting a medical marijuana license, because you're going to let it get to the point where you're going to end up being a dope fiend on Oxy.
Yeah, that Oxy is horrible. I've seen it ruin people's lives. So yeah, stay away from that. Opiates in general, a lot of people get addicted. People don't understand the beast that they unleash by taking these prescription drugs. So yeah, if you have problems, like, be careful with what you're doing, people. Because,
but I mean, socially, people would rather you do that than smoke some pot, right? Like, that's how ridiculous this is. Like, cultural wise, there are people that would just disown you, turn up your nose, never speak to you again if they found out you were smoking marijuana. But they're perfectly okay if you've got a prescription for Oxy.
Yeah, it's crazy, but
because they don't know.
Yeah, they don't know, and it's also social, environmentally, they were raised, and people see it as a legal reason. A lot of people that come to California, because I deal with a lot of people from conventions and, from the Midwest that come out, and they're tripped out by how free weed is out here, and, people don't care, and it's nothing, it's just part of, society. And, but their biggest thing against it is that the legal ramifications. If it wasn't illegal to them, they would actually be less against it. And the reason why it's illegal is for, bogus reasons. So over time, as generations shift and, younger people become in power, I think that, the laws will change. They'll see this as a viable economic thing. And it's beyond just medical. Ultimately, weed is good, I think, on a social level. I think there's a lot of ways bridges could be crossed, there'd be less wars, people could smoke it out and talk out some problems. You'd be amazed, situations where I've just, interacted with complete strangers just because we shared a joint, and, cool interactions and meeting people and just opening up. It's like sharing a drink, but, ultimately you're not going to get into a bar fight if you get too stoned. So
yeah,
I think there's an element of it that's great for just society in general. It's not a scourge. And it really, over time, maybe you'll learn this. And in California, where I'm at, we've been having this for about the past 10 years. So eventually, people will catch up to it, and I hope it does get to that point.
Well, I look at how far it's come in a very short time. I mean, I realize the battle's been going on for decades, but in a very short time, we've seen such progress that I'm hopeful that, you know, it's not going to take very long before this becomes, you know, quite mainstream.
Me too. It'll definitely be in our lifetime.
For sure. Yeah. Even if it's just the current guard realizing that they're not going to stay in power unless they do something about it.
Yeah. So, before we get too off track, one of the things I wanted to make sure we gave Marcel a chance to do was, you know, pimp some of the projects that you're working on that you got out there. I mean, not everybody is going to know, that Marcel has all these podcasts and other projects. So hit us up. What are you doing out there?
You catch me on my main podcast, Brainstorm Brewery, along with Corbin, Hostler, Ryan Bouchard, and Jason E. Alt. We can find us on GatheringMagic.com, BrainstormBrewery.com. We do that every week. It's a financial podcast if you haven't heard it. We definitely have fun. It's enjoyable. It's about an hour. We keep it concise generally. We have a lot of fun with that. I also do the Smooth Brothers with my brother Tyrone.
Nice.
MTG Brainstorm. We got that on ModaDeprived.com. You can find it there. We're going to record. We do it every 2 weeks, roughly, depending. Sometimes every week because of our schedule. But it's hard to do that. So about 2 weeks, but you can find that. We have a good time with there. It's a lot of budget brews. So we do a lot of brewing and we talk about ways to save money playing Magic.
And it's a good cast. I like the Smooth Brothers thing you got going on there. I think it's, you know, a little unique in the, not so much in the content, but in the sort of the style that you've got going for that one. I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I like it. I like the chemistry. I didn't, you know, at first I was like, is this really going to work out? And we started doing it. I was like, oh yeah, this is going to perfectly work out. Like we got something here that's going
to
be cool.
So. Yeah, there's a stylistic tone to it that's just different than what other thing everyone else is doing, which I really appreciate. Even though, as you know, as I've said to you before, I think we talked about it. It's a little hard for me personally to listen to. Just at least that first one was just be that rep. You know, that repetition of the music was kind of driving me insane. So,
yeah, the first one and the second one is not that great, but when you get to 3 and 4, it's a bit better. And I'm going to be very conscious of the future songs and make sure that they're as least repetitive or whatever the hell the word is. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
It's that awesome. First one, it was like brain warfare for me. I'm just like, oh man, I really want to listen to this, but I can't take it anymore. You know, it's not as reflective on you guys. I think it's probably a very small percentage of us that feel that way. But for me, I just couldn't do it.
Some other people hit us up. You're not the only person that did this. They cannot listen to it whatsoever. And I empathize with everyone. We decided that ultimately we're not going to release it without the music. It's just going to be part of what it is. But we're going to do our best to make sure the music is tolerable and make it less obtrusive so that it just fits in there. So hopefully...
I think the music is a big part of that sort of that stylistic tone you've got going there. I think it's great. And like I told you that before, like I wouldn't change anything that you're doing other than, you know, hopefully you guys will find the right sort of the right kind of music that will make it, you know, pleasurable for everybody to listen to. I'm going to go back and now and check out, you know, 3 and 4 and see how that goes.
Okay. Let me know.
But no, I wouldn't change a thing. I love what you guys are doing. I think it's a great cast. I think there's a need for that kind of information, and I like the style of what you guys are doing.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the kind words. I really do. I really do. And I like what you guys got going here.
I hope I didn't talk anybody out of listening to it. I should have just kept my damn mouth shut, but
no.
Definitely
that,
I hope
I
didn't
warning. Tell people to start at 3 or 4 and not get it. Like it at 3 or 4, you're just not going to like the cast. And if you don't like it, that's all right. There's other casts out there for you.
Oh, man, there's so many casts out there right now. I can't find enough time to listen to them all.
Right.
Which is a great problem to have, right? I mean.
Yeah. But I find time to listen to this cast every time because you guys got something good here. I honestly will say.
I appreciate this.
It's good.
Yeah.
Content community.
Like, you know, as I'm sure you feel about your projects, you know, we just do it because we like doing it. And I would do it if, you know. Nobody listens just because I like talking to Josh and I like talking to guys like you. I mean, how else am I going to get to know Marcel?
You go to GP Portland.
Oh, I guess so. I guess so.
Exactly. Kevy's going to be there.
Oh, man. Is that helping me go or is that keeping me from going? I don't know.
Well, yeah.
It's like a wild man. I don't know.
It depends on how much sleep you want to get.
everyone in the SVU should hang out with Kevy. Hanging out with him in Vegas, let me know that, yeah, he's a fun person to hang out with. And if you're part of the SVU, I'm pretty sure you want to hang out with Kevy.
GP Vegas, that whole sort of podcasting house thing was just, man, you have no idea how jealous I was after you guys, after it became apparent of how much fun you guys were having.
That's what we're doing again in Portland. Like,
oh, man.
You got to be there. There's no reason not to. You got 6 months. You know,
yeah.
Portland's one of those really modern, laid-back cities, too. A lot of good food there, too.
Excellent food there. It's going to be great.
Well, I'll have to start checking out how much it's going to cost me to get there.
Shout out to Maddie also. I don't know if I get that. And Mildy and who else? I'm going to forget people. Skymo. I know he's on the Twitch stream.
Tommy Moles.
Oh, Tommy Moles, of course, T-Moles. Yeah. And then Totally Gubby.
I hate that Tommy Moles guys, by the way. Just we have this thing going where because he plays land in front, I just automatically hate him. So.
Oh, yeah. Everybody learned that way, though. Come on.
No.
I mean, anyone who played back in the day, you know, when we were playing with Revised, there, no one ever said, here's how you need to set things up. So it was always land in front. I don't play it now that way, but that's how I learned to play.
I don't think Tommy even plays land in front. He mentioned it one time, now we have this thing going. So he knows I love him. All right. Well, you got anything else that you're working on? Just you got those two podcasts. Anything else you're working on putting out there?
We got the stream, Brewski Bistro. We're still trying to work that in. My schedules are so busy, but that'll be there occasionally. So I'll stream. We did a stream barbecue. I did one time. That was great. I barbecued and then streamed some Legacy. So
nice.
I'm try to make that a regular. So I'm going to figure it out. It's just a matter of time. I just don't have the time, and I want to put out a consistent product, and I feel bad if I don't. So I might get there. We'll see. We'll find out.
So that's that stream that's going on now, is it just you or is it other people that are doing it as well?
I'm pushing it to be just other people. We're going to have like Ray Future Pro. He did Raymond Perez Jr. He just was on the Pro Tour. He plays 37. Shout out to Ray. Crushed that shit. But we're going to have people like that. I'm trying to get Ryan, my co-host, get on there, and other people. We're going to filter it around. So I'm working on that. It's a project that's on a back burner because there's other priorities and time issues. But I've been talking about this for years, so I can't say that it's going to happen.
Awesome. Well, anyone else you want to shout out before we call her a night and let you get back to your lady?
Shout out to everyone I forgot to shout out because I'm bad at that.
You hear that? Everyone listening just got a shout out, so you can't say you didn't get one.
There you go.
Shout out to Robot Large.
Yeah. At least you do that. Those fuckers over there on Heavy Meta don't shout me out anymore.
They did shout outs this week. I don't remember the last time they did them.
Yeah.
They just out of nowhere were like, Ferret was like, it's time for shout outs. Let's do them. And you still didn't get one.
They've fallen out of vogue now.
Well, yeah, I think they. Well, the end, and as much as I love the show, they really need to stop with the "there's a certain city" part, right?
Well, I think that's
you just get there and you're like,
that's what stole all the shout out time is this dance between Kevy and Maddie over how they're going to end the show.
I
actually like that better. I like it better than the shout outs are cool, but I ultimately, like, you know, if you're not one of the people getting shout out, you're like,
what I mean to say is Maddie will do it right. And you're looking at the time left and it's like an hour and 10 minutes. You're like, am I going to listen to them try to end this for the next 70 minutes? You know, they kind of did it this last one in the middle of it because the guest had to go, but it's just, when I see there's 40 minutes left and they're like, let's try to end this. It's just like it's going to fall off the tracks.
But you know,
sometimes they do all right. But
you know what Kevy's like. I mean, we had him on here. He wouldn't let us end the damn show.
No, he's all energy. I can't imagine Kevy sitting in a chair reading a book ever.
Or playing magic across the table and not being jumping out of his seat and burning your deck with his lighter. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
How does that not happen?
He seems like the type of guy that, you know, you'd sit down, you'd go over to his place, you'd sit down, he'd say, you want a drink? Okay, here's a drink. We're going to sit down. He's going to go mountain go, and you're going to play your land. He's going to go lightning bolt. and you go, and then he plays, you know, Ashes Elliot or whatever, and then you go and you take some time, so he just jumps up and he goes in the kitchen and does something for a while. He's just like, let me know when it's my turn. It'd be like, it's just, it's all energy all the time. I don't have that, so it would be interesting to know what it's like to be in that just hyper go. Like, what does his downtime actually look like? He's probably asleep, right?
No, he's listening to us right now. That's what he's doing. He's going on repeat. They're talking about me again. Let me rewind this.
Yeah, but you know what he's like. I mean, he just won't let you finish. So I kind of get a kick out of the whole dance at the end of the show. I think, I don't know, it won't continue forever, obviously, but while we have it, we can enjoy it.
Indeed.
Yeah.
It gave us some great things. You know, Maddie ended it for the first time in 60 episodes. It was the first time he'd ever done it, so.
Yeah, there you go.
It brings some other stuff out.
I actually got a good one for next time. I prepared something.
Oh, you prepared something for the next time you're on?
Yeah, so we'll see what that happens.
All right, well, there you go. Our listeners now will be waiting for
the next... It's a future Easter egg, yes.
Yeah, it's a future Easter egg. You'll be waiting for the next Marcel appearance and be expecting something big.
Damn it, I made Easter eggs for just a second. It's a complete sidetrack. Anyone who saw or watched last week's magic show that Evan Irwin put out, I put an Easter egg in it, and no one has found it yet.
Ooh. Interesting.
I'm not going to tell you what it is, because to me it's a very glaring, obvious thing, and I even had to tell Evan that I did it, but there is an Easter egg in one of the graphics that I did.
So All the listeners, obviously check that out.
That could be the homework, right?
We want
find
your...
the Easter egg in
exactly.
last week's magic
That's
show.
Your homework. We want to hear your guess. Put it in the comments and to see if you can guess what the Easter egg is. Because I watched it, but now I got to go back and watch it again.
Exactly. I didn't even know.
It's very well done, and you probably don't realize that it's there. How's that?
Oh, man.
I think it's well done. You might think it's crap. But...
Are you getting kickbacks from Evan to get his viewer count up? Is that what this is all about?
No. I did get a little bit of store credit for it, which I was extremely grateful for, but his direction on those was, I would like it to be something like this. He didn't say, use this picture with this and this and this. It was a very organic thing. It was a tremendous blast to do, and I was very honored to do it. Couldn't wait for it to come out and see what he did with it.
Yeah.
I didn't do the Planeswalker coins. I didn't have time for that. But just about every other graphic in that I did.
Sweet. Okay, well, I think we should call her a night. Marcel, thanks for coming on. I know it's been a bit of a struggle to get the timing right, so we really appreciate you working with us and coming on board.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for having me. I'm honored that you wanted me on your show. So,
oh yeah, well you're infamous in the SVU, man. I mean, we got to get to know who this Marcel guy is.
Well, thank you. It was a great time. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Well, Josh, as usual, it's been great casting with you again.
Yep. A big, huge shout out to Marcel for coming on and talking steak with us.
All right. Go ahead, Marcel.
No, I said thank you, Josh, for dancing. You were tangoing with me. It's good to have a partner, you know?
I'm a terrible dancer, so if steak's something I know.
Might have something to do with the fact that you're like 50 feet tall. I don't know.
Well, it definitely doesn't. Well, yeah, my wife is – I'm 6'7". My wife is 5'4".
Yeah.
How do you do the giraffe boogie?
What? The net. I don't even know what that is, but poorly.
All right, folks. Well, thanks again for listening, and I just want to remind you all to make sure you check out all the great content on ManorDeprived.com, and especially, thanks to KYT for hosting this show. He really believes in what we're doing here. So make sure that if you're listening, make sure you're hitting us up in the comments. We want to hear, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly, and we want to make sure that we keep the comment numbers up so KYT will. Keep us on board. We won't have to go finding a new home.
Yeah. Shout out to KYT. Shout out to Scotty, Jeremy. And I'll see you guys out there. GP Junk Train.
All right. Well, thanks a lot to everyone. And remember, if you're listening to this, you are the SVU.